This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeline Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, Cautionary Tunes, the fantasy and history behind folk songs and nursery rhymes.
So,
this was my idea, mostly because I got really enthusiastic having read the first book of the Kestrel Saga, because Madeline's actually used at the Scarborough Fair in it, and it, you know, I'm not going to spoil it, but the way she did it made me laugh so much. It just got me started thinking about folk songs. And from there, I went to nursery rhymes.
But it is interesting because I literally only added that bit into the book on a kind of whim. I just thought, oh, I'll do this. No one else would probably find it funny. And then Jules contacted me saying I was laughing out loud.
Yeah, I mean, it was unfortunate that I was at work at the time and probably shouldn't have been reading.
Who'd have thought that librarians weren't allowed to read? Nursery rhymes and folk songs and the like are something that both Jules and I are particularly fond of. Jules has used, we've both used them within our own works, and we might discuss that a bit later. But I also run a folk choir, so I especially am fond of the dark, scary folk songs. Usually have something to do with the dead.
And once a week, as part of my job in the library, I run a mothers and toddlers group, and we do sit around and sing nursery rhymes and bits of folk songs and things as well, the bits that are easily to remember, you know. There's less about the dead, in fairness, unless it's very heavily disguised.
Well, I mean, a lot of nursery rhymes have got some very dark themes in them, disguised in a catchy tune and, you know, symbolism.
Yeah, and that's where I balk a little bit with some of the nursery rhymes, because nursery rhymes were never originally intended for children. So much isn't really originally intended for children, like fairy tales, nursery rhymes. Folk songs, myths and legends. It's not, that was the entertainment of the day. Nursery rhymes, it was a case of most of the population was illiterate, so you couldn't send news to the general populace that way and expect them to digest it. Mm-hmm. It just didn't work that way. So setting the most important part of the news to a catchy tune and then having it hummed and sung up and down every inn, tavern and bawdy house from here to London was probably the best way of doing it.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, there is science about, I think they're pretty sure there's science about the fact that putting a tune and putting rhymes to something makes it more memorable.
Yeah, I mean, it's the whole reason that in some ways we do this mothers and toddlers group, because, you know, music actually helps brain development and it helps the centres for linguistics, which obviously you want for a young child. I mean, people bring their kids along from 6 weeks old. That's how young they start off. So I say toddlers, but actually they're very small. It's all about development. And it's really interesting for me, just as an aside here, seeing them come along when they're perhaps sort of a couple of months old, and they might stay for up to a year, year and a half. And watching the children during that time get more adept, and you can actually see them becoming more dexterous. You can see them doing the actions to the songs and things themselves, and you can almost see them connecting the words with the actions. You can almost see them connecting the tune with the words. It's really, really interesting, and it is a good setup, if you like, for then the child then learning to read later on.
Yeah, you know, they say that listening to Mozart when you're a baby or when you're pregnant sort of raises your child's intelligence. And I don't know about that, but there is, you know, a repetitive, the aesthetic of Mozart's music and of the music of the time was patterns.
Yeah.
There were patterns in the music. Pattern recognition is very similar to rhymes. It's another form of pattern. And in particular, dyslexic people learn through rhymes and shapes. So, for instance, I struggle to read a long word if I don't to sort of to spell it all out. But I recognise words as shapes, And actually, it's been shown that most people respond better to the curriculums which are stylized for dyslexic people than the regular curriculums that we currently employ in schools. And I think, again, it comes down to what our brains are good at processing, and we are good at processing patterns. And that's really possibly another reason why rhymes and the like have stuck around for so long, and why they come so quickly to us, even though we learnt them at a very young age and we might not have said them in a long time. They leave a lasting impression.
Yeah, definitely. Which, going back to why we have nursery rhymes pretty much from the beginning, is why I kind of balk at some of them, because I think you're saying this sort of mindlessly, and okay, the kids are enjoying it and everything, but you don't actually know what you're saying. You don't know the meaning behind it. And possibly that, in fact, in all actuality, that doesn't matter really. Most of it isn't too lewd and tasteless. But there's certain things like, it really irritates me. There was a drive recently to make it Bar Bar Rainbow Sheep. I absolutely refuse to do that because it's just so, I know people say that nursery rhymes are nonsensical, but that is so nonsensical. It just irritated me so much. I said, no, that's fine. I just won't do that nursery rhyme.
Couldn't you do something like, I mean, you could say Bar Bar Blue Sheep.
Okay, and I realise this is my problem, but it's the meaning has been so completely warped that they're assuming that Bar Bar Black Sheep is in some way a racial slur, and it's not. The meaning behind the nursery rhyme is to do with the 12th century wool laws. So the original lyrics were, you know, Baa baa black sheep, have you any wool? Yes sir, three bags full. And then it goes on to, it should be two for the master is the king, one for the dame is the church, none for the little boy who cries in the lane. So basically the shepherds did not get anything. They basically got pennies for rearing the sheep and producing the wool.
Yeah.
And this was all during a time when wool was probably Britain's biggest export. The Flemish wool merchants used to come over every year and buy it at the sheep markets. And a very tidy profit could be made out of it. And there were lots of hands greasing other palms and backstage deals and things going on. And there was a big struggle at the time between the church and the king. And this was when Stephen was on the throne.
And ah, Steve.
Good old King Steve. And Henry II was trying to marshal his army in France. So the fact that somebody sort of tapped on it and said, oh, no, we can't use the word black in a nursery rhyme, it sort of irritated me to the point where I said, I'm not going to do that because that is so utterly nonsensical. It's got nothing to do with racism whatsoever. It literally is about wool. So there you go.
I learn something new every day.
And it's the same with most other nursery rhymes. It's like Pop Goes the Weasel.
I never got that one.
it's sort of a work rhyme, and it sort of dates back to the 18th century, and it's to do with late 18th, early 19th century, when they started to use machines in mills and workhouses, and it's a rhyme so that you make tedious work go faster, but at the same time it's also a rhyme that talks about how we're doing this really shit job. It's dangerous, some of us losing fingers, particularly the children. And what we get out at the end of it is just a pittance that we can just about afford to live on.
Yeah.
So that entire song is about the workhouses.
Ah,
the weasel was a nickname for a piece of machinery that went on a weaving machine.
Ah, so it's not an actual weasel.
It's not an actual weasel. Just like the monkey in the second verse that you knock off the table isn't an actual monkey.
Yeah, I was going to say. Where do they live, in a zoo? Why are all these animals running about? It's very dangerous.
I mean, I think that's where it's interesting with nursery rhymes, because, you know, while we're talking about workhouses, you've got Wind the Bobbin up as well. That's an innocent one that I do pretty much every week because it's got simple actions to it. But that actually comes from the same workhouse era, and it was children who were too young to really do any work in the workhouses. It's a game they used to play, and they didn't have anything to eat. They didn't really have any toys. They'd be sat outside. It might be absolutely horrible. And the whole idea is you're pulling against each other's arms to strengthen yourself up, and the person who lets go gets punched.
Ah, that's
and it's all
fun.
There in the song.
It's great.
So there you go.
Violence is always the answer.
But there's also really hilarious ones. Like, I think I remember when I was very small, my gran giving me a bath and sort of doing rubber dub dub. Really, rubber dub dub's not appropriate for children at all.
Do I dare to ask?
Well, you know how it goes. Rubber dub dub, three men in a tub, and who do you think they are? The butcher, the baker, the candlestick maker. How did they get there? There's slightly different lyrics to it. What dub or dubbing or drubbing is another word for sex, basically. The fact that it's a butcher, a baker, and a candlestick maker, it refers to the long-held and little-talked-about tradition of running same-sex peep shows for the entertainment of the gentry.
Right, got it.
Not that they were just same-sex ones, they changed it to three maids in a tub as well. So, and you know, they were paid quite well for it, I understand, but it goes back sort of around to the time of Henry VIII.
That doesn't surprise me, actually.
It probably shouldn't. I don't think that's the same rhyme that was used, but essentially the tradition of having same-sex peep shows.
Hmm. Now, I've got one. Do you know anything about Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, that one?
Not specifically, no.
Because that was obviously used in that film. Literally, Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy. But it's not actually spy, is it?
No, Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Sailor, Rich Man, Poor Man, Beggar Man, Thief. I think it was a skipping, clapping game.
Yeah.
I can't remember the start of it, but it's something along the lines of who shall you marry?
Of course. Yeah, so it was a counting game.
Yeah.
There we go.
Another one that is surprisingly not child appropriate is Lavender's Blue.
Why not?
Because Lavender's Blue, Lavender's Green, is all about a man trying to trick a woman out of her maidenhead. By promising her the earth and saying, you know, we'll let everybody else work and we'll keep ourselves warm in the hay, love. Do you fancy a roll in the hay? It didn't used to be dilly dilly, it used to be diddle diddle. Diddle diddle is also sex. And it's got such a lovely tune. It sounds like a lullaby. It sounds appropriate for children. It's just really not. It's quite creepy.
Well, I mean, another really common one, and this is about death, is Ring a Ring of Roses.
Yeah, there's a bit of argument over that. I've always thought it was to do with the Black Death, but it does go back to the 1300s, the actual nursery rhyme. And it wasn't written down for 500 years, and there's a bit of question that if it was really to do with the Black Death, why wasn't it written down? But to me, it makes more sense that it was to do with the Black Death, because if you think about it, we had waves and waves of it, and then we had a really terrible period of the plague during the 1600s. And it when it was actually written down.
But it wasn't sense. The first time it had come to the shores.
No, absolutely not. And I suppose the thing to consider with Black Death is the fact that during the 1600s, the reason it was spread so badly in Europe initially was that it was to do with the Borgias. The Borgias were taking a lot of power, and certain other Italian houses, if you bear in mind that Italy was various different sovereign states at the time, actually used the Black Death as an early form of germ warfare. So they sent infected articles of clothing, not really knowing what it was causing it, but obviously it was the fleas carrying the virus. And of course, then you got people like merchants and people who travelled carrying the disease instead of people who lived in areas where you tended to get more rats.
Well, and then, and it was also, I mean, it wasn't just done, it was used in warfare during seizures as well.
Yeah.
They'd throw bodies over the walls, infected bodies, into the city they were trying to siege, and just literally just wait for everyone in the city to die.
Yes.
Or to just be too weak from illness. So yeah, so that's Ring a Ring of Roses. I remember dancing to Ring a Ring of Roses.
Yeah.
And thinking it was the jolliest thing ever.
Yeah.
And then someone sitting down saying, no, this is what it's about. And I was there like, oh, must you spoil everything?
But weirdly, I think I thought it was even better when they explained that.
Yeah, to be honest, so did I. That's when I realised I may have a problem. So yeah, Ring a Ring of Roses is one of the is one of the big ones that comes to mind when you're thinking of inappropriate songs and meanings. But actually, to be honest now, very few people don't know that Ring of Roses was about, or is presumably about, the Black Death.
Other one, Humpty Dumpty.
Yes. Now, if I'm correct, that's actually about a cannon.
Yes, that's right. Well, I mean, that's the most plausible explanation. There's another theory that it was about an overweight sharpshooter based in Colchester during the Civil War.
Okay.
I think it's far more likely that Humpty Dumpty was in fact a cannon used by the supporters of Charles I during the Civil War. There certainly was a cannon, probably of that name or a similar name, that was used to keep the opposite side at bay and managed to do so admirably for about 11 weeks until the tower was destroyed and the cannon fell and broke. Which is pretty self-explanatory in the rhyme, really.
Yeah.
What happened was, obviously, you got Lewis Carroll writing Alice Through the Looking Glass.
Mm-hmm.
And Humpty Dumpty was betrayed as an egg because we'd lost contact with the original meaning. And then that became very popularised, so Humpty Dumpty was an egg, which, when you think about it, makes no sense at all.
It really doesn't. And yet everyone thinks of Humpty Dumpty as an egg, even though in the rhyme there is no mention of eggs at all.
No.
So thanks, Lewis Carroll. Printed it into our minds.
There's a good one. Well, there's loads. There's so many that are based around the Tudors. For example, there's A Little Nut Tree, which is about Catherine of Aragon.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's Three Blind Mice, which is about Mary the First.
Yeah.
Basically, with Three Blind Mice, obviously you had her brother Edward on the throne. Edward was in a state of hunting down Catholics and burning them alive, which didn't sit very well with his sister. And a lot of...
No one ever really talks about that, though.
No, they don't, do they?
They all go about sort of Bloody Mary, Bloody Mary, Bloody Mary. And you just say, like, well, it was really Bloody Tudors, Bloody Tudors, Bloody Tudors. They were all pretty rotten, to be honest.
Yeah. Anyway, obviously, Edward's legacy came to an end because he only managed to reign for 3 years before he died. But there were three religious leaders who were quite important at the time, and they were very keen to keep Mary off the throne. And they encouraged Edward to really persecute the Catholics. And of course, Edward died, Mary came to the throne, and those three religious leaders came to a sticky end. You know, she cut off their tails with a carving knife.
I dread to think.
Anyway, that's what Three Blind Mice is about. And there's also Mary, Mary Quite Contrary, which
yes.
There's an argument about whether that's about Mary, Queen of Scots, or, you know, Mary the First, but it could be about both. It could have been used for one, and then someone said, actually, this kind of fits with this Mary as well.
Yeah. Because it's, what was it? Mary, Mary, Quite Contrary, How Does Your Garden Grow with...
Silver bells and
cocker shells and three little maids in a row.
Pretty maids in a row, but I could
three,
be wrong.
Yeah, three pretty maids in a row. Because I think that the association with Mary, Queen of Scots, was obviously her history and the sordid love affair. I say sordid. You know, she had all sorts of crazy kind of things happen to her and lovers and them getting stabbed and killed in front of her. And she had a very interesting life, it must be said. Quite unfortunate. But at least she went out with a bang.
Yeah, as you say. So basically, most nursery rhymes are to do with a historical event, generally.
Yeah.
There's Dr. Foster as well, is the other one that springs to mind, which is about Edward the Longshanks visiting Gloucester and misjudging Gloucester gets quite a bit of rain, misjudging a puddle and getting himself and his horse stuck in a ditch and having to be pulled out by the local townspeople to great amusement. Not his, obviously. He was quite
obviously
annoyed.
Not. What about the Grand Old Duke of York? 10,000 men.
That goes back to the son of Mad King George, who was basically sort of almost Regency time. George mm-hmm. III, the generally Duke of York, is a title given to the firstborn.
Yeah.
But the firstborn is given to the secondborn. The firstborn is always Prince of Wales, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right.
Assuming there isn't another one. At the time, the Prince of Wales is the sort of Randy George that we know about and laugh about in Blackadder, and was also known as Georgie Porgy from another nursery rhyme, Kissed the Girls and Made Them Cry.
Oh, that was him!
Yeah, it rhymes about all of them. Yeah, I think it was supposedly about the second son and general ineptness. I mean, really, they weren't terribly Right, as sons.
I'm so sorry. So general ineptness.
General ineptness. Something to do with the French Revolution, I think.
Yeah.
Anyway, if this interests anybody, a really good place to start is a book called Pop Goes the Weasel by Albert Jack.
Jack, Pop Goes the Weasel.
Yeah, that's a good one. He's written some very good books on etymology and folk phrases and things like that.
Excellent.
So, yes, nursery rhymes contain history, or they contain cautionary warnings about, you know, men who will say sweet things to you to get you to roll in the hay with them.
And then we get to the folk songs, and these are usually also about men trying to say sweet things to women to get them to roll in the hay. And then songs about the women who did and got pregnant and the men abandoned them, and now they wish they were dead. And then finally, death. But interestingly enough, talking about Pop Goes the Weasel, work songs and work rhymes were very common, and sea shanties were obviously used to help workers keep in time, to help sailors keep in time.
Yeah.
And also to keep their spirits up. And the topic of these would vary from place to place, though they did tend to have a similar kind of tone. And I always like to think that they start, that when they sort of set off, they started with the, you know, the randy dandy, now we are ready, hurrah, off we go to the sea. And then as kind of they got further on, the song started to change to the, oh, I miss my beloved. Oh, the devil is here, kind of thing.
Yeah, the fairest girl waits for me back home in Liverpool. Yeah, going on back to the virtue question, there's a couple actually, but one in particular that I can't remember the song very well, but it's Let No Man Steal Your Time. And time as in the herb, not time as in time.
Oh, okay.
And time stands for virtue in folklore.
Yeah.
It is quite, I mean, the whole thing is a heavy metaphor. It's kind of like, don't let anybody else go digging in your herb beds kind of thing. It's like, you couldn't be much more obvious if you hadn't called the song, yeah, don't let a man fuck you and then leave you.
Goodness me, Jills.
There's an American South equivalent called Someone's Been Digging in My Potatoes.
Yes.
And I don't think I need to explain that either. What is interesting, though, is the idea of, you know, across the board, earth, fertility, and perhaps it's absolutely fine as long as, you know, you've selected a particular gardener and you're not letting just anybody plant seeds kind of thing.
It is peculiar because you go from songs which are very, very purely symbolic. And then you have others which are just, they're not wasting time, are they?
No.
They're just laying it out.
They are.
And oddly enough, I wish, the songs where a woman has gotten pregnant and then been left on the wayside, they tend to be pretty sort of plain spoken about what happened. But it's the songs all about, you know, sort of let me woo you, let me, and they decorate it with poetry, and those are all very, very symbolic.
Not that it's all just about, you know, virtue or whatever, there's various other things. Folk songs were entertainment as well, so a lot of them encapsulate the darker, more Celtic types of fairy tales or ghost stories, and mm-hmm. they also contain historical events.
Yes.
As well. So there is a trio that I will mention that I'm really, really sorry for anybody who is just completely outlanded out, because we know it's not historically as representative as it could be of the time. It wasn't just the evil English versus the virtuous Scots.
I don't know what you're talking about.
The Scots were selling each other out. The Lowland Scots were selling out the Highland Scots. But it is reflected in the songs. There's the Skyboat song, which Bear McCreary has actually adapted for Outlander as a theme tune. The Skyboat song's really interesting because the original song tells the story of Bonnie Prince Charlie fleeing from the Battle of Culloden in 1745 dressed as a washerwoman or a maid,
mm-hmm.
and is helped onto a boat by another woman and makes his escape to the Isle of Skye.
Yeah.
And obviously it's been adapted, the lyrics have been changed slightly. Robert Louis Stevenson changed the lyrics himself before that and made them a bit more simplistic as well. And then it's obviously a rich period of time for that sort of song, because there's also the really derogatory to the English song Camille Fra France, which literally slags off King George all the way through. once you unravel the Highland Scots, it's actually really, really funny, but as an example, it's like, "Cam you for France, cam you down by London, saw ye Geordie Welts and his bonny woman. Were ye down at a place called Kittle House, saw ye Geordie's Grace riding on a goosey." What they're basically saying there is, you know, have you come down from France, obviously? Did you come via London by any chance? Did you see George and his lovely lady, as in his mistress? Were you at the place called the Kittle House? The Kittle Housey is a bawdy house. It's a brothel.
Right.
It's St. James's Palace. So basically, they're saying the court of St. James is full of degenerates.
Yep. Fair enough.
Saw ye Geordie's Grace riding on a goosey? Now, it's like, did you see George shagging a whore, basically? The rest of that song pretty much goes downhill from there.
Can't imagine how that does that.
It's even less flattering the further down the song you get. But the thing is, it's got a lovely tune, and it's fun, and the Highland Scots is also fun as well. It's only when you unravel it you think, actually, this is really offensive. No wonder they didn't like it.
Well, interestingly enough, a lot of music and you know, as well as for spreading news, folk songs and rhymes and things like that could also spread rebellion.
Yeah, they were used for propaganda as well.
For propaganda. And that includes carols. For instance, the 12 Days of Christmas, you know, everyone still really kind of enjoys that song, on the first day of Christmas. But it is speculated that it was actually written for Catholics to be able to celebrate Mass without anyone knowing. So they'd be there singing this song, and actually what they were doing was that they were conducting a Mass. They were speaking, I think it was the Creed, wasn't it? Yeah. And that's what it was. So it was how they were able to get away with it right in plain sight by making it into a song. And spreading propaganda against the Brits was quite a common thing to do.
Do you mean Brits or do you mean English?
I mean the English, not the Brits. Sorry. against the English. You kind of see it a little bit in The Rocky Road to Dublin. And again, he sort of has to board a boat and whatnot. And he sort of gets cheated by certain people and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But it was also about spreading kind of ideals and images and stories which could have otherwise gotten you arrested. And songs could still get you arrested, but it was much harder to pin them down because songs are catchy. And if they were coded, then you wouldn't necessarily have, they wouldn't necessarily have been picked up by authority figures. And one of the main ways of doing that was to make the song sound jolly and was to make it sound, you know, to make it memorable, because then everyone was humming it.
Yeah, and obviously you didn't want people going into taverns and inns and pubs and things singing laments generally. What you wanted was someone singing something cheerful. But what's behind the cheerfulness is absolutely vicious in a lot of cases.
Yeah.
Like Rocky Road to Dublin is really a call to arms for all the Irish brothers who happen to be working in England to band together and not take any crap from the English kind of thing.
Exactly, yeah.
And there's Parcel of Rogues in a Nation, which is, you know, going back to Scotland, is slightly more of a lament in a way. It was written by Robert Burns,
mm-hmm.
and it's to do with the Act of Union, whereby Scotland and England became known as part of Great Britain. And it is literally a big sort of been sold out by our countrymen. We were bought and sold for English gold, is how the song goes.
Yeah.
And there's lots of very patriotic to Scotland type motifs in the song as well. So Scotland's quite a good place for it because they have actually ballads and things didn't get stamped out in the same way they did in other more accessible places. So they were able to collect quite a lot of the old songs.
Yeah, exactly. And again, that it also stems back from that oral tradition, I think. and keeping it alive. And you get music like this comes out of places which have been faced with misfortune. And that isn't just in the United Kingdom and in Europe. Moving a little bit away, you know, moving away from folk music, you look at the songs that would have been sung in plantations, and these were songs of liberty, and the revolution, the quiet revolution that was going on with slaves way before you know, the revolution actually began, the official one, has been erased, and yet you can still see evidence of it in the music, and in certain cultural things which have remained, which are very, very clever. And yeah, it's interesting that folk music in particular stems from places of misfortune.
I suppose where I feel a bit sort of sad about some of it is the fact that you have these great Irish, Welsh and Scottish ballads and things which were in the traditional style and might have been sung for hundreds of years, and they were catchy, and obviously the English came along and nations were conquered, etc. And they liked the catchy tunes, and it wasn't unusual for them to be then translated into English, and then the original ballad or lament was lost. So it might survive in, you know, it might survive in the sense of the chorus, but quite often they didn't speak Gaelic, so the chorus got turned into nonsense words.
Yeah. So yeah, the things were lost, I guess, in that sense.
Yeah. But, you know, there's still like quite a rich history and folklore there as well. I mean, I by default always sort of liked folk music, but there's, I grew up listening to things like Molly Malone, which is basically a ghost story, but it's a really cheerful ghost story until you realise that she's died.
Yeah. My uncle performed it for Halloween, and I was listening. You know, I had heard it before, but I'd kind of forgotten. I was there like, oh, this is nice. But he said this was going to be a ghost story. Oh, okay.
And then this one's like, do you know Alison Gross?
Yes.
Alison Cross.
Yes. Yeah,
that actually delves back into the old fairy myths and legends. Because anyone who doesn't actually know the song, it's about a really, really ugly witch, the ugliest witch in the North Country, who tries to persuade a young man to be her lover by combing his hair and then offering him nice clothing and things like that. So strangely, quite what would be quite a traditional empowered male doing to a female type thing. And he turns her down. And he's obviously not very diplomatic, because she then turns him into an ugly worm. Actually, it's an ugly worm, meaning a dragon.
Ah, right.
So I always thought, my God, that's awful. He's been turned into an earthworm. And it's only when I saw the lyrics written down, I thought, no, you turned him into a dragon, which is still pretty bad, in fairness.
But you know, could
be
worse.
It's not as bad as being an earthworm. But there's another verse that doesn't get sung very often, and it's the queen of the Seelie court comes along and sees the dragon, takes pity on it, strokes it 3 times, and turns it back into a handsome young man again.
Oh.
Which I find a less satisfying ending in many ways. I don't know. I think that says more about me.
No, I'm with you there. I mean, there's always a tale to be told. Is that when dealing with fairies, you tricked me.
Another
dealing
good one.
With fairies, you've got to be polite.
Yes, really, really polite. Very diplomatic. Even then, it might not do you any good, because there's also Thomas the Rhymer. And Thomas the Rhymer, when he sees the lady of the Seelie court come riding over the Burnie Brae, is extremely polite, even flattering, but he means it, and she can see that he's sincere. So she takes him with her, and to reward him for his sincere compliments, she gives him a fruit that will mean that he can only ever tell the truth. And he says, no, thank you very much, my tongue's my own. And she said, yeah, I don't think so, makes him eat the fruit anyway. So he can only speak the truth, and he can only speak it in rhyme. So even though he was polite and diplomatic, he still gets punished for it, but they do let him go after 7 years, in fairness.
Well, I mean, I'd like to point out the best way of dealing with fairies is just not deal with fairies. Just avoid them.
There aren't many songs about
that. At all costs. just don't engage. Ignore them. If you can, because then they'll just presume that you can't see them. Don't engage, and if you have to engage, just be polite, and hopefully you won't get eaten or cursed.
I mean, if you've got a song that tells you to bind certain types of herbs and things to your person when you're travelling, usually that's to ward off the fairies.
Good advice, people.
Good advice. And as you said, there's some really good ghost stories as well. There's the Unquiet Grave, which I find quite oddly moving.
Yeah.
It's literally just saying you mustn't be taken over by your grief. It's about a girl whose lover dies, and after a year she's still mourning by the grave, and that night the ghost comes up, and I think it's probably Halloween because it would be, comes up and speaks to her and says, you know, you're going to be in the ground with me, basically, if you don't pull yourself together. You know, there's grief, and then there's a case of you're grieving to the point where you're forgetting to live.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that, actually, is a ghost story. That's quite nice.
But that is a quite nice a ghost story. And it's actually interesting because you do get these ghost stories which are quite nice. The Molly Malone one isn't actually that sad, really.
No, it's not. It's a kind of like, well, she's still doing what she was doing before. It's just she's dead now.
Yeah. And even Danny Boy is, I mean, it's a little bit sad, but not that sad.
No, it's not really. As she moves through the fair, is actually quite sad, I think.
That's an incredibly sad one. And oddly enough, actually, whenever we talk about this, I think we've just got time to sort of discuss it briefly. We still have a little bit of time, so I thought we could talk about how we've incorporated music into artworks.
Yeah, okay, cool.
And in particular, She Moved Through the Fair. The story of She Moved Through the Fair is this couple who are going to be married, but the bride dies before they can be married, and the groom basically keeps dreaming about her. That's the shortened version. And oddly enough, that song is a song that I incorporated not into into the book itself, but the themes of it. I really sort of set it as the kind of theme for Rufus and Mylène.
Yeah.
To the point where I even used some of the language, so her feet made no din, things along those lines, because it is an incredibly moving song and it's incredibly emotional. It's one of my favourite folk songs of all time. And incorporating folk into and rhymes into books and into any sort of form of writing really adds another level to it. I think it creates something extra, and it can be used to sort of to heighten the atmosphere, but also it can be used to create a sub story that is self-contained. And that's something that you've done a lot of, Jules.
Yeah, I wouldn't say I necessarily started out doing it deliberately. It was just a case of that seemed to be the place for it. And obviously my main character in Unveiled is a musician. So, for example, putting Long Lankin in, it's like there wasn't a great stretch there between the Watcher on the Moor and having this basically quite creepy song about a murderer who lives out in the moss.
You know, there was enough fine place to live.
There was enough. Yeah, again, it's one that Long Lankin's a really quite creepy song. I mean, he kind of gets his just desserts at the end, but it is still really quite horrible.
Yeah.
And again, I music sort of runs all the way through it. And I suppose in the next two books, the last two books, second half of the quartet, again, there's more folk songs as well.
Yeah. There's a sea shanty, isn't there?
Yes.
Did I make that up? Yeah.
No, you didn't make that up. But I think that's the thing, though, because perhaps it's because it carries so much history with it. You're introducing, because what you can do with books and what certain authors have done is they literally tell a folk tale within the original tale to sort of highlight some of the things that are happening within the story. Yeah. And that's good, but some people find that diverts them from the plot, whereas a couple of verses of a song here and there sort of can be a bit more subtle, perhaps.
Yeah.
And people can ignore it if they want to.
Yeah, and also people can then go and find out about the song. And one thing I like is that some people say, oh, I saw the song, and so I listened to the song whilst reading the scene, and it adds to that scene. It adds something. I mean, because that's what I did with Long Lankin. I was there like, well, this sounds creepy. Let's go and have a look at Long Lankin. So I listened to Long Lankin, and that night I was just shivering in bed like, oh God.
It's a really good creepy ballad.
I did it with my choir, especially for you. So yeah, folk songs have a big part in our culture, both as cautionary tales, rebellion, and, well, a number of other things. And they can be used for, not for good, that sounds a bit much, but they can be used to great effect in writing now because of the strong association they hold with history and with myth and with magic and with rebellion as well.
Yeah, definitely. Before we go, can we talk about Scarborough Fair? Because that's a bit of an unusual one.
Let's talk about Scarborough Fair. I'm glad we left this one to the end, because Scarborough Fair is a bit of an enigma.
It is quite strange. Now, the way... Do you mind... You explain how you used it in the Kestrel Saga, because I don't want to say anything that you don't want to give away.
Well, basically, the plot of Scarborough Fair as a song is it's an exchange between two lovers, or just one lover, who is ordering her lover, or his lover, to complete this list of impossible tasks, and then they can be together. The idea is that maybe they've fallen out. So the first one is tell him to make me a cambric shirt, parsley, sage, rosemary, and thyme, without thread or needle. I've just forgotten all the words.
Without any seams and no needlework.
Yeah, that's right. And cambric shirts are obviously very finely stitched style of clothing. So it's impossible. And then it's sort of it continues on this list of absolutely impossible tasks. And at that point in the book, Kestrel is committing her own impossible, is trying to perform her own impossible tasks. So she starts to make up verses instead, and she starts to be a little bit cheeky about them, basically saying she's doing all these things and the utter futility of what she's doing and the utter madness of the person who sent her to do them, to do these tasks. And so that's what she's doing there. It just seemed, I thought, well, because I knew she had to start singing at one point to distract herself and also to sort of stay hidden. And Scarborough Fair, because of the kind of passive aggression that kind of worms its way throughout it, because some people can see it as very melancholic, but I always read it as very passive aggressive exchange between two lovers,
yeah.
Who just start to sort of slowly one up the other on the impossible tasks that they're telling the other to do.
Yeah, it's really funny, and it made. Because obviously I'd heard the Simon and Garfunkel version, and I'd known it before that. I'd heard it sung by various different folk groups, and I, you know, you can know something so well that you've stopped listening to the lyrics.
Yeah.
So you can even sing it and not really think about what you're singing. So it made me go away and look at it after, you know, laughing a lot because it's very funny. And then I was looking at it and I dug a bit further, and then I dug a bit further, and the song actually goes back around 500 or 600 years past something which is quite an obscure ballad called The Elven Knight. Mm. The Elven Knight comes out of hell or a fairy mound, depending on your viewpoint, and says he will abduct a young maiden for his bride unless she can complete these impossible tasks. She replies with a set of impossible tasks for him. You get to the end of the song, and again, it's mildly creepy because most of them are. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the song, he no longer wants to enslave her. He wants to offer her an honest partnership because he kind of likes the cut of her jib and her wit and her intelligence.
I like it.
Which is good. But the original, The Elven Knight, doesn't have the parsley, sage, rosemary and thyme line. Now, what's interesting about that is if you look at the folklore of herbs, this is obviously something that's added a bit later to slightly different lyrics, all those herbs mean different things. Now, sage obviously means wisdom, and usually it's wisdom to do with being able to process your experience.
Yeah.
So you've become older and now you understand life a bit more. Rosemary is for remembrance, and sometimes it's associated with regret, so you're remembering something in the past. Thyme, obviously, we've covered, it's virtue.
Yeah.
Parsley's the really interesting one. Parsley has got two major associations with it. One is death.
Mm-hmm.
And the other one is being crossed in love. So you've got those four herbs there, and you've got parsley saying either somebody's died or somebody has abandoned you. And then you've got sage, which is you have wisdom now, having gained it from experience. And you've got rosemary, which is remembrance. And you've got thyme, which is virtue.
Yeah.
Which gives it all a slightly different slant.
It does.
Then if you add that line into the whole, you know, make me a cambric shirt, etc., it's kind of like, well, it does actually say you will be a true love of mine. It's like, well, if you can complete this impossible task, I'll take you back. So it suggests that one lover has done something really bad.
Yeah. And the other is, there could also be another reading there, which is that it might very well be that one of the lovers is dead.
In which case, so it's impossible. You can't marry someone who's dead.
Exactly. So they're saying that we can be together again if you can do the impossible, then we can be together.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's a great song. It's a great song. I really, really do love it. And I've actually rewritten it a couple of times. One was for Kestrel. Another time I actually rewrote a version of it to tell the story of Finn McCool.
Yeah.
And so I changed it from Parsley, Sage, Rosemary and Thyme to Elder Oak, Ash, Apple and Thorn. Again, with the same vein of what the trees, what the association of the trees are.
Yeah.
And what the association of the tale is, and it's the tale of Finn McCool against the Lochlannach.
Yeah.
And I just love it. I love it because you see these songs and they seem so utterly random now. You're like, why are they suddenly talking about fruit and vegetables? What has this got to do with anything? It's like they were singing a very serious song and then they spotted a herb patch and just started reciting what they could see. And actually, there's so much depth to it. And the moment you have depth is the moment you kind of get uncertainty. And the moment you have uncertainty, it leaves room for interpretation. And that is just fantastic, because you can really play around with that song. If you look at the association of just from Parsley alone, of Scarborough Fair, you could have it as a really funny story about two lovers arguing. Really arguing and sort of trying to, you could make it very funny, and then
you could make it very bitter.
Yeah, you could make it very bitter, and then you could have it as something totally tragic about two people who are desperately in love, but one of them is dead and is saying, "I wish I could be with you, but this is the reality. So unless you can do all the, unless you can perform the impossible, we'll be together." And just from one word song alone, you get that, and I think that's amazing.
And what makes them so effective is the fact that they, on the surface, are very, very simple. And yet they're not at all.
They're not. They're not. Yes. There we go.
Well, we better put a pin in it for today.
All right, then. Well, thanks for listening, guys. And we'll catch you next week.
Yeah. Thanks and goodbye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note, no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.